Welcome to Inflection Point, interviews with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, the causes of cancer seem to be everywhere.
It turns out that it's nobody's job in our government to take data from the peer-reviewed medical literature and turn it into policy. In other words, our regulatory system is actually deaf to the voice that the data has and the message that it's trying to give.
Fighting the cause of cancer. That's our inflection point. There are many risk factors that impact whether a woman will get breast cancer, genetics being the one we hear about the most. Yet studies have shown that environmental carcinogens play a significant role. Our guest, Sandra Steingraber, is a scientist who has made a career out of identifying these links and taking action to change the course of our history with one simple premise: data. Welcome to the program, Sandra.
Thanks for having me.
So data was at the heart of your campaign against fracking in New York. How was that a pivotal element? How did you use that in your efforts?
Well, science is what stopped fracking in New York. And it was very clear when the governor announced our ban last December that he was following the advice of his Department of Health commissioner, who had reviewed the science on fracking and determined that what we knew about fracking was troubling, and what we didn't know, what the data gaps were, meant that it would be wrong to roll this out with what we know now and under any regulatory framework known to us. There's no evidence, there's no data to show that it could safely protect New Yorkers. And that was an amazing moment for those of us in the public health community, because it meant that the system worked the way it should always work, which is that there's evidence for harm, data emerges, we have troubling signs of risk and harm, and that should be enough to push the pause button until we can sort this out further. And in fact, that's exactly what happened in New York. That said, it's not easy. It's not easy because it turns out that it's nobody's job in our government to take data from the peer-reviewed medical literature and turn it into policy. In other words, our regulatory system is actually deaf to the voice that the data has and the message that it's trying to give. And so it's not enough for those of us in the scientific community to publish the data dutifully or even translate it into simple English and bring it out to people via press releases in the media. In fact, we have to insert ourselves into the political process with this data and insist that policies are made that reflect what the data show and that people's health are protected.
Where does the data typically come from? In this case, were you collecting it yourself? You mentioned peer review medical journals.
So I'm a founding member of a little group called Concerned Health Professionals of New York. And as we in New York debated whether to permit or prohibit fracking, we went to work, and there were just a handful of us. And so we translated the science into English and then began to take it out to people. We went to church basements on Friday nights. We went to town halls, and we went to where people were, and we kept showing them the data. And of course, we were working in a moving stream of evidence. So when we began this, there were less than 60 studies in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. And there are now more than 500 studies in the peer-reviewed medical literature. And in addition, there are now government reports. There's some investigative journalism that's very important, because journalists know how to do things like file Freedom of Information Act requests to get a hold of data that even scientists don't have, and so on. So when we compile all this together, it becomes like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. And in the early days, we only had a few pieces, if you will, of that 500-piece jigsaw puzzle. But now we have more than 500 pieces. And so a startling picture has begun to emerge. And the preponderance of data, the weight of the evidence, shows harm. And so that's what became determinative in the state of New York. And so the more we in the scientific community went out to give these church basement talks, the harder it was to keep our PowerPoint presentation down to 15 minutes, because for a while I didn't even have to use notes because there was so little data. But now I'm trying to keep track of literally, I think, 683 footnotes is what I was looking at last night as I put the final changes on this document.
Well, since it's top of mind and fresh, what are some of the links that you are seeing between fracking and cancer causing?
So we looked at sort of 16 or 17 different themes, and there are about 10 trends that we identified. One of them is we have absolute proof now that fracking contaminates water, and that there are many activities within the process of fracking that are linked to water contamination, not just like one piece of it that we could control. And we also document that air pollution follows fracking wherever it goes. This is an inherently leaky process. So we're trying, in the case of fracking for gas or oil, there's always other gaseous vapors that are trapped down there in the shale. And when you blow the bedrock apart to get at the methane, which is natural gas, or the oil, all these other things kind of come up. Including benzene, formaldehyde, radon gas, and these things are inherently leaky. And then we were able to look at regulatory frameworks of all kinds and show that there's no evidence that any of them actually work, that there are inherent engineering problems with fracking, that you know, these well casings that are stand as a gasket between our drinking water aquifers and the oil and gas containing bedrock below, they have to remain a barrier to contamination for all time. But cement and steel are not immortal substances, nor are they bonded to the parent rock. There are all kinds of naturally occurring fractures and fissures. And so there are pathways of contamination that cannot be controlled through any kind of engineering. But most disturbing are now the emerging signs of actual health effects. So we saw a big study released from Johns Hopkins University, study of 10,000 pregnant women in Pennsylvania, showing that the more drilling and fracking activities near your home where you live as a pregnant woman, the higher your risk for high-risk pregnancy and preterm birth. In fact, preterm birth increases by 40% with a lot of drilling and fracking activity. That's really alarming to us in the public health community, because preterm birth is the leading cause of disability in this nation and the leading cause of infant mortality. And it's a ruinously expensive problem. It blasts families apart and incurs a huge medical cost of billions of dollars to our nation. So anything that sabotages pregnancy doesn't really belong in our society. And if we're become dependent on a form of energy extraction that harms prenatal health, it's really time now to call for a ban and a moratorium, which is what we successfully did in New York and what I'm also calling for here in California.
So is there any way of preempting them before you get started? So in other words, if a company decides that they want to do fracking, or let's just say it's another new technology that we don't even know what it is yet, is there a way to study what the potential harmful effects could be before they actually get in there and do it and affect human lives?
Right. So this is a problem that affects both toxic chemical marketing as well as energy extraction techniques, right? And in other words, demonstration of safety is not a precondition for marketing something or for going forward with this technology. And that is an inherent problem in our whole system of doing things. But I think even more profoundly is that we have these two interconnected problems. The problem of toxic chemical exposure, which is, I would say, a human rights problem, because we're all being exposed to these chemicals without our consent, and they demonstrably raise our risk for cancers and for other problems. And then we also have an energy system that is about to tank our planet's climate system, upon which things like plankton depend, plankton providing us half the oxygen we breathe. Pollination depends on a stable climate, which provides us about a third of all the food we eat, and so on. And so these are interlinked problems, because the toxic chemicals we worry most about are petrochemicals. They are, in fact, the products made out of the waste left over from an energy industry that's terribly dependent on fossil fuels. And the fossil fuels have become so powerful as an industry that our government is held hostage to it, but also innovation is held hostage. And, you know we have green technologies, both for chemicals, and we also have green energy. But these things can't really be fully deployed because we're being stuck in the 19th century, because we have to keep blowing fossils out of the bedrock with ever more extreme technologies that are toxic, shoveling them into oven and lighting them on fire. I mean, this is this kind of primitive technology that we're stuck on right now. So this is, I think, the great challenge of our time. I'm interested in trying to do with energy and chemicals what we've already done with telecommunications, right? And so nobody would say, gee, we just need to stick with the rotary dial phone, and, you know, and you can't go get an iPhone because good old rotary dial, that's the dependable way, you know, and yet that's the message we're being told about this unholy trinity of oil, gas, and coal. You know, that's the good old reliable, no matter how toxic, no matter what the cost to our health, to our kids' future, it's the reliable one, and everything else is kind of cast as fickle or something. And I'm really interested in using data to turn that narrative around. It's really wind, sun, and water power. We know we have the technology to support our economy using those forms of energy. And it's really fossils that are brutal, primitive, and not reliable.
Well, so in California, they recently created a goal that is a goal under law, right, where we have to get to 50% renewable energy.
Right. And you recall that the law originally had two parts to it. The proposal was to increase renewables by a huge amount, which is great. But the other part was to decrease fossil fuels. And that's the part that, after industry pressure, got left out.
Yeah. So even if it has to get to 50-50, does that just mean that we're going to be consuming more energy and that the amount of actual fossil fuel energy will remain the same?
Well, it's a worldwide commodity, right? So these things can go elsewhere. So our challenge is, too, as I see it, we have to open the door to green chemistry and green engineering and green energy while closing the door on fossil fuels, and it really requires both. So Governor Jerry Brown has his sights set in the right place. It's wonderful he wants to increase renewables, but you can't wear the mantle of a climate hero simply by putting more solar panels into California. You also have to leave the bedrock unfractured. You can't keep blasting the stuff out of the ground and lighting it on fire and think we can have a stable climate. There's no evidence to say that. It's just a delusion and wishful thinking.
Well, what is stopping energy companies from updating their technology to cleaner approaches?
I'm no economist, but I can tell you what it looks like from the state of New York,
yeah,
where we did ban fracking. But geographically, upstate New York, where I live, lies between the shale fields of Pennsylvania and the urban markets on the East Coast. And so we're now in the process of dealing with these fossil fuel infrastructure projects that would build pipelines and the compressor stations that would push the gas through the pipelines all across our state. Our state has also been selected to be the hub for storage of fracked gases, because these things are gas, and so storing them is tricky. I guess what I'm saying is that if we lay down the infrastructure, if we allow this project to go forward, the amount of money that it takes to build these storage facilities, all these compressor stations, the pipelines, the return on investment is decades, right? And so you can't do that and also build out renewables. You know, you can't go down two roads at the same time. They're leading in two different directions. So on the banks of Seneca Lake, there's a fight going on. And as I see it as a biologist, it's a fight between the past that wants to keep doing the same old fossil fuel thing and the future that says, no, we're barring the salt caverns. You can't have the keys to our salt caverns. And we have another vision for our future that's based on sustainability. Meanwhile, this lake is a source of drinking water for 100,000 people. And in an age where fresh water is becoming ever more scarce, as climate change makes fresh water unavailable, we see increasingly the value of having this pristine body of water, right? So it's an amazing time to be engaged now with these issues. Everyone is very concerned. There have been 400 arrests at the gate of Crestwood, including myself.
Yourself, yes.
But including also, you know, a 90-year-old great-grandmother, including faith leaders, including winemakers, including health professionals, a whole bunch of nurses and midwives. We had the biggest arrest was 41 people who were all school teachers. And so these are like everyday people in the community who are rising up to say that it's time to protect the climate. This group of people call themselves We Are Seneca Lake, out of recognition that if you drink the water, we're all 65% water by weight. So we are this lake. It's our blood plasma. It's our cerebral spinal fluid. That's very meaningful. And it's very interesting to watch the standoff between a big fossil fuel company and people who live in a place who are trying to defend it.
Well, when you're looking at new technology solutions, we talked about renewable energy. How do we know that they're not going to have similar kinds of consequences to health and the environment? How do we get ahead of this?
Well, happily, science doesn't have to always rely on simply let's try it and see what happens, right? So before you would market a brand new car, you would crash test it. And you don't put real people, you use crash test dummies. And so you can simulate and model, is my point. And so with technologies that we already have, some of which have been deployed, we can, through modeling and also through actual deployment, see what kind of impacts that we have. And, you know, there are problems with wind turbines. Sometimes they kill birds. Sometimes they're at a frequency that makes sound pollution. But we can tinker with those things and redesign them or take them down if it's too bad. But by contrast, when an aquifer is contaminated, there is no solution for that. It's just permanently ruined. And in a place like California, where the oil and gas here are held in a fairly shallow way in the ground, so that means when you frack, you don't need to use as much water as in other states, but that oil and gas is contained within a lot of briny water. So what comes out, by the time you separate the oil from the water, you have a lot of wastewater left over. It's very highly contaminated with some really nasty stuff that could hurt you. We don't have any solution for where to safely contain that. And California has now acknowledged that it wrongly allowed the oil companies to actually inject that waste into freshwater aquifers that are now forevermore ruined. And so there's a difference, I would argue, in the kind of consequences, a difference in magnitude. If the consequences are permanent, large, and irreparable, that's different than consequences that you can fix, that you can create workarounds for and tinker with.
Now that you're focused on California and preventing fracking here in California, what is your method for rallying support? I mean, you did an amazing job of that in New York. You got 500 different groups together to make a difference. So how do you generate that support when you're just starting out?
Well, that's already happening in California. And so the Californians Against Fracking are kind of the standard bearer, and they've been working here for a long time. Part of our success in New York was through grassroots activism. And that's because I think the larger green groups, because they're donor dependent, they really rely on winnable victories. And they're more willing to settle for a small victory that they can say they've accomplished this, even if it's not completely stopping something, a real abolitionist perspective on this. And so the power of our movement in New York was that the people who were on the frontline communities were willing to say, no means no, and we're not interested in trying to regulate something that we all know is by its nature inherently dangerous. There's no right way to do a wrong thing. And so the grassroots really led, and then the large environmental movements eventually followed us, and they had, they have the ability, they have access, they have money and things that the grassroots don't have, but it was really a movement led by science and led by the grassroots. So that's the model, I think, that will win the day here in California. And there's some really great groups kind of working on that, who are mobilizing grassroots groups here.
What's the best advice about activism you've ever received?
Just to never give up, I think. I spoke to a woman in New Mexico meeting with people who are trying to stop fracking there. And so I met a woman, Navajo, who succeeded in stopping a coal-fired power plant in her community. And I asked her what her secret was. And she said, determination and never giving up. I said, oh, that's basically my secret too. You know, you just get very stubborn about it. And she lives in a place with no running water and no toilet and very little resources. And so it was a real lesson for me in how far you can go, you know, just with that. So for me, that determination comes from being a mom and realizing that basically all my tasks of parenting kind of fall into one of two categories, right? You have to provide for your child's future and you have to protect them from harm. And then also, I had cancer myself as a young woman. So I was 20 years old and diagnosed with bladder cancer in between my sophomore and junior years of college. It was really my diagnosing physician who asked me questions about my childhood exposures, which seemed crazy to me at the time. But once I went back to college as a biology major, I could read around in the medical literature and pretty much determined that the questions he was asking me, like, had I ever vulcanized a tire? Which, of course, I hadn't.
I don't even know what that means.
I'm not sure I did either. But it turned out that was the right question. And his other question to me, you know, have you ever worked in an aluminum smelter? Well, no. But there was one not far from where my house was, where the house my dad built. So it was that kind of put my feet on this path. And also, when I went back to my hometown years later with a Harvard postdoc and went to work as a kind of environmental detective there, I discovered I was just one of a cluster of cancers, you know, as one data point in a much larger collection of data, and that people have been studying the excess rates of cancer, but nobody had actually done anything to protect the kids, you know. So this is what I feel strongly about, that these problems that we have with environmental health are more than just a grant opportunity for those of us who do research. We can collect the data, and that's important, but you have to stop the damage and stop the harm and protect people. It turns out in my case, the drinking water wells were contaminated with dry cleaning fluid. That happens to be linked to bladder cancer. Now, I'm only a sample size of one, so I've never claimed that that's the explanation for what the question that all cancer patients ask, which is why me, right? But what I do say is that kids should not grow up drinking perchloroethylene, which is a chlorinated solvent. It shouldn't be there. We don't know who's going to get harmed, but we know somebody's going to get harmed. Maybe it was me, maybe it's somebody else. But somebody was asleep at the switch. You know, some adult who, before I was even born, should not have allowed those aquifers to become contaminated. And so I am lucky now. I'm 56 years old. I just had another cancer checkup. And there's some troubling signs. So now I'm in for more testing. Bladder cancer of all human cancers is the one most likely to recur. So this will be part of my adult life forever. And so far I've had a good outcome, but it's no fun. And it's kind of miserable to lie in the stirrups, you know, every few months and watch the inside of your bladder on the big screen television and go through all the fear that you have about it coming back. So I'm determined that no other kid, not on my watch, and certainly not my kids, are going to have to be treated with such recklessness when we have so much knowledge and so much data that we're not using to make the world better. So I proudly call myself both a scientist and an activist, and I feel that there's no contradiction there, that there's a difference between being objective and being neutral. Like, I'm a real believer in objectivity as a scientist, and I think all scientists take pride in their ability to look at a bunch of data and make sense of it. And when you do that, you're suspending all of your thoughts about everything else and just letting the data talk to you. You know, what's the sample size here? What are the confidence intervals? What's the statistical power? And at the end of the day, if what you see from the data shows that people are being harmed, especially children, then you can't remain neutral. We all have an ethical obligation, whether we're scientists or not, if you know that somebody's being harmed, to say something and to do something about that. And so that's the piece of it that after I'm done being a scientist and I can see that there's harm, my job is not done, I feel. It's not enough to dutifully publish about that. If elected officials aren't listening and the data are being swept aside, we have a moral obligation to not stop. And you can't just throw up your hands and say, well, I tried, you know, we have all this data, but no one's listening. You have to make people listen. And part of that is taking the data out to the affected communities and explaining it to people in a language that makes sense to them and empowering them with the knowledge so that they become a political force at that point. And you can move the needle on public opinion. And that is what I've discovered elected officials will listen to. So it when people are empowered by the science and they're knowledgeable about the science, and the more they learn about fracking, the more they don't like it, then that's a pretty good combination. So that's what I'm interested in.
Sandra Steingraber, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Sandra Steingraber. A link to the latest scientific data about the harms of fracking can be found at our website, inflectionpointradio.org. Be sure to listen to our interview with Karuna Jagger of Breast Cancer Action.
It shouldn't be up to us to go through, read, try to pretend that we're experts in toxicology. There's experts who do this. This is their job, and this is what our government should be doing to protect us.
That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, listen to previous shows and sign up for our email updates. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/inflectionpointradio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller. Thanks for listening.